Rambunctious elementary school kids saved by the bell? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
If we find them, we probably have a good idea that an area is healthy.
That's the bean screaming for its life.
Basically, you're allowing air to bubble through.
There are things that you do that influence your friends, friends,
friends.
You can't
have people making claims and selling tests that have not proven they work yet.
2 to 3 million people in the United States known to be living
without
bubbles.
I think it's fantastic. Itchy eyes, sneezing.
No, when upwelling happens, it's when you have these really
nice... Different shakers.
Yes, she can go home.
Everything should be patient-centric.
On today's show, maximalist running shoes, a far cry from the toe-glove barefoot trend, a slow resting heart rate, coveted by some but maybe not a key to longevity, and building the mega computer of the future. But first, let's begin by finding a comfortable position, perhaps resting on a cushion because we're going to meditate.
Take a deep inhale. Gently exhale.
Mindfulness meditation is becoming as popular as yoga. It's the practice of being present in the moment to really pay attention to what is happening around us and within us.
Notice the air coming into your body and filling your lungs.
Everybody's doing it. Stressed out parents, police officers, CEOs, doctors, nurses. Research has shown that mindfulness meditation has a positive impact on people's health and that it's effective in stress reduction. Could this practice also focus fidgety school children and improve their ability to learn? Stephanie Marudas reports.
Skipping recess to meditate might not be what most kids would choose to do, but here in the lunchroom at Isaac Shepherd Elementary School in North Philadelphia, this loud bunch of third and fourth graders is about to get quiet. They gather around teacher Jamie Roberts. She's going to take them to her classroom for meditation club.
Remember that when you hear the bell, that's to remind you to return your attention again and again to the way it feels to be walking. Okay?
At the front of the line, a child strikes a bell, and nearly 20 kids walk silently up several flights of stairs. When the kids get into Robert's classroom, they congregate in a circle. Some find spots on the floor, others wriggle into chairs. Roberts talks briefly, and then a designated student recites a series of phrases that the group repeats.
May we be safe and protected.
Whisper it.
Some kids look around, squirm in their seats, make funny faces, or whisper to a friend, while others have closed their eyes and take deep breaths. And by the end, the group appears calm.
My name is Andrew, and I'm in third grade. Meditation changed my life because I was like stressed out. But then when I found meditation, it kept me happy and calm.
My name is Serena, and I felt really, really mad. I just felt like I want to hurt people. But when I got here, I felt calm and I feel relaxed, and that's it.
The club's origins trace back to 2010, when Jamie Roberts was doing meditation on her lunch break to deal with her own stress. Some kids wanted to learn to do the same, and so they started a club. In its first year, Roberts says a shooting happened outside of the school, and it left many of the kids shaken.
That night, a lot of the kids had trouble sleeping. So the next day, when we had meditation, I asked if anyone wanted to talk about it, and one girl raised her hand and said, I couldn't sleep last night. But then I meditated, and then I could sleep. Two other kids kind of like raised a finger and nodded like they had done the same thing.
Some kids have taken more to meditating than others, including this student here. She describes what seems to be a mindfulness practice known as the body scan.
My name is Nayana. I'm in third grade. If your shoulder or your head hurts, you can just close your eyes and take deep breaths and just go to your shoulder or your head and just feel how it's feeling, and maybe after you'll feel better.
2 miles away from Isaac Shepherd, a high school meditation club has taken shape at Mariana Bracetti Charter School.
Let's see if you can gently bring yourself back to the feeling or the sound of your breathing.
In her classroom after school, teacher Andrea DeCero does some guided meditations. one of the club's members, is Karan Gaines.
Before mindfulness, I just felt confused, and it was like everything was happening too fast. But now that I've been doing mindfulness, you know, sometimes I'll stop, take a deep breath, and think about it.
Student athletes like Ronald Palmer have also done mindfulness training with Andrea DeCero. Palmer says doing focused breathing has been helpful on and off the wrestling mat.
Say, like, if you're about to get in a fight or argument with somebody and you don't want to fight and you want to make the right decision, you come back to mindfulness and you take a deep breath and you walk away from the fight. I did it a lot of times.
Breathing more slowly can help to reduce autonomic arousal, which can be deleterious and can result in more impulsive decision-making.
That's Richard Davidson, a neuroscientist and leading researcher on the impact of mindfulness on the brain. He's the founder of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin.
And when people are actually paying attention to what they're doing, they actually report increased levels of positive emotion and well-being compared to periods of time when they're distracted.
Most of the evidence right now on mindfulness-related practices comes from adults. And according to Davidson, few rigorous studies have been done on children and teens. His group is interested in finding out more about the impact of mindfulness training on things like the regulation of attention and emotion, the ability to focus on a specific goal, and cognitive control.
And to the extent that mindfulness practices help directly in promoting these kinds of regulatory skills, and also secondarily reducing the impact of stressful events and enabling people to cope more adaptively with those events, we would expect to see gains on these kinds of functions. But we really need to do the research before we can more definitively say that this is helpful during this period of life.
Among the few evidence-backed programs out there to teach students mindfulness is the Learning to Breathe curriculum, created by Penn State researcher Trish Broderick. She works with teachers to first develop their own mindfulness practices before they get trained in the curriculum and teach it to students. In a recent study at two comparable suburban public high schools in the Philadelphia area, Broderick tested what would happen when one of the school's concert choirs did the curriculum weekly for 15 to 20 minutes over 18 weeks.
And we looked at emotion regulation in the students. In other words, were they aware of their emotional states? Were they clear about what they were feeling? We looked at their stress level. We asked them about their somatic symptoms and things like how cranky they felt, whether they could concentrate or not, you know, if they had aches and pains.
And the study showed students made improvements on these measures, while the comparison group, which did not do the curriculum, either stayed the same or did a little worse. Broderick finds the results promising, but acknowledges the study's limitations, including self-reported data by students, the limited sample size, and scope of the target group.
We'd certainly like to know what this would be like to do it in all the classes in a school as part of a regular curriculum. That would be the next step in terms of making this more sustainable.
And researchers like University of Virginia's Tish Jennings are getting closer to finding out whether students benefit when teachers bring mindfulness-related practices into the classroom. She's currently running a randomized controlled trial with 224 teachers who, as a group, oversee thousands of students across 36 New York City public elementary schools. And so far, Jennings says half of these teachers have gone through mindful awareness and emotion skills training as part of a professional development program she created.
If you can help teachers in this way, can you improve the classroom climate? And in turn, does it also improve student academic and behavioral outcomes? So we're collecting data from teachers and asking teachers to report on their individual children.
Jennings' findings could be a game changer for how mindfulness-related practices take hold in schools. For The Pulse, I'm Stephanie Marutis.
May I be happy and calm.
Our next story is about a seemingly basic question.
Did you hear that?
Hear what? Hey, y'all hear that?
Did you hear that?
I heard that, I understood it, but how? Reporter Tanya English wanted to find out, so she met with a scientist at the University of Pennsylvania in their department of otorhinolaryngology, that's ear, nose, and throat for the rest of us. So here's what Tanya found out from researcher Maria Geffen.
Sound is basically vibrations, pressurized vibrations of the air. In the case of speech, they're produced by our vocal cords. If I clap my hands, you can imagine this almost physical vibration in the air.
Maria Geffen says scientists already understand very well the mechanics of hearing. They know how the ear converts sound waves into electrical pulses. Say the word hot.
Hot.
And that sends
hot.
Sound waves hot. Traveling hot. To your eardrums.
Hot.
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 It's hot.
Not too hot.
But what's really interesting to Geffen is the next step. Given all the different accents and background noises and speaking rates, how is it that we extract meaning from that sound?
How does the brain then, once it sees the signal, the series of zeros and ones, this electrical impulses, how does it then put it back together into hearing actually the words? And that's what my laboratory is trying to solve.
Geffen's team uses the chirps and trills of rats as a proxy for human speech. The researchers play the calls, then monitor the lab animal's brain activity as cells called neurons begin to fire.
You can think of them as kind of a set of Christmas lights where they just go on and off, and you can almost see this lights travel.
Maybe you've heard these kind of squawks and shrieks from a rat before. But in Geffen's lab, she works with the ultrasonic chatter that rats use when they're talking amongst themselves. To play that chatter for us, Geffen slows down the song to drop the pitch into a human hearing range.
So all of these vocalizations were recorded while two male adolescent rats were engaged in friendly play. But we don't know what exactly they mean. Is that kind of like one rat is saying, let's go play together. And the other rat says, oh, okay.
The scientists train the animals by playing the calls and at the same time asking the rats to do specific tasks, maybe poke a nose left or poke a nose right.
If they do that reliably, then we can actually say, oh, they heard this sound or they heard that sound.
And those sounds come to mean something. The scientists watch for patterns in the neurons. Put another way, they measure how and where the Christmas lights light up.
And then we can tell, well, do those neurons matter or do those neurons not matter for their perception? Without understanding how our brain does that, we cannot build better hearing aids or to improve the design of cochlear implants.
In her lab, besides rat songs, Geffen also works with nature sounds. We hear this, and she says we all think water. And more precisely, we think gurgling brook.
We know mathematically what is it within the sound waveform that makes it sound like the brook or not.
Next, Geffen plays with that knowledge. She takes the same recording of the babbling brook, but this time strips out the signal that makes the brain think water.
That doesn't really sound like anything. Maybe static noise on the TV.
The scientists also add that particular sound property that Geffen has isolated to create a completely man-made sound.
You can make my brain think that I'm listening to gurgling water.
That's right. That made all the difference in you hearing this as an artificial sound or a gurgling water brook. And what we'll find is, yes, a bunch of neurons are sensitive to those water sounds. But that's not gonna tell us how is it that that sensitivity comes about.
Geffen and her team are just beginning to crack that code. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Oh, did you hear the thunder or the rain? Means I'm coming home again. Means I'm coming home, my friend.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. I'm still struggling to understand most of the functions on my smartphone. Meanwhile, some of the biggest technology companies in the world are quietly chasing the holy grail of the information age, quantum computing. They're hoping to build a computer so powerful it would do everything from solving incredibly complex mathematical riddles to sorting through the universe of data collected about us. But as Todd Bookman explains, the first challenge is getting the quantum bits to dance how we want them to.
Before getting too high-tech, let's go back to 1938. A brilliant physicist, an Italian named Ettore Majorana, withdraws all his money from a bank and boards a boat. Then, somewhere between Palermo and Naples, he vanishes without a trace.
That's a million-dollar question. I wish I would have an answer. Majorana disappeared, and a lot of theories, a lot of speculations have been made. What can I say? The answer hasn't been found.
This is fellow Italian Lorenza Viola, a Dartmouth College physics professor. She researches what's come to be known as the Majorana particle. The year before his disappearance, Majorana published a paper theorizing a revolutionary concept, that there was something out there that could be both a particle and its own antiparticle at the same time, a quasi-particle floating around in the subatomic world. Decades later, scientists have come to believe these properties would make it a good base for a quantum computer. Today's digital computers are built around bits, all the zeros and ones that run our machines. The idea behind a quantum computer is that instead of bits, you have qubits, which can be a zero or a one or basically both at the same time. The problem is, so far, the qubits researchers have identified keep falling apart when put into action. Viola says the Majorana, because of its peculiar qualities, may hang together.
The fact that once created, once identified, it would be harder to destroy them, and so they would be intrinsically more stable, more protected, and so potentially more useful in a qubit. I don't know if it makes sense, but that's the idea.
At this point, the Majorana is still mostly theory. In 2012, a team of Dutch researchers came the closest to proving its existence. But if someday finally harnessed, researchers will face a second challenge, getting it to do the computer operations they want it to. UPenn physics professor Charles Kane says that will require a concept called braiding. The Majorana particles get braided together into patterns to maximize their power.
What I want you to imagine is a square dance party where the two-dimensional plane is the dance floor and the particles are the dancers. And the caller tells you to do a do-si-do. So that means you move around your partner.
All join hands in the center, fall and up once more for the good of the hall. Then swing your partner, swing them all, then promenade around the hall.
The way that a quantum computer accomplishes a computation is by making the quasi-particles dance around each other.
Huge sets of data get tossed into the qubits, which dance and compute and then spit out the answers. Math problems that would stump the computers of today could be worked out in short order, including factoring numbers with hundreds of digits. Professor Kane says right now, researchers are still at the early stages, working to tame the systems.
It's a very difficult problem. You have to understand your materials and you have to have control over them. And that's requiring sort of real state-of-the-art technology.
And that requires big money. Companies like IBM, Microsoft, and Google are pouring tens of millions of dollars, if not more, into the field. Practical applications may be years off, but a working machine could advance encryption technology or drug research or any other area where big data holds answers.
It's a risky venture, but if you can make a quantum computer, then you can do something that other computers can't do.
That's got companies and academics like Dartmouth's Lorenza Viola still combing over the physics Ettore Majorana first put forward 75 years ago, before his mysterious disappearance.
I think if he could see us or somehow be here, he would be very pleased because certainly he's left a big legacy.
And who knows, maybe in another 75 years, Majorana will be a household name. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman. La, 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 la.
Thank you.
basta dopo che sillabe per esprimerti quello che dice il cuore, il cuore, il cuore.
Coming up on The Pulse, intensive care and the emotional scars it leaves behind.
Nightmares, dreams, visions of just about any and everything you can possibly imagine. Visions of, you know, kids running around with animal heads. I thought they were trying to kill me.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. A familiar backyard scourge is spreading shoots this time of year, striking fear into suburban America.
I was getting people walking by through the township looking at that and eyeing it and, you know, swerving their baby carriages out of the way. And I thought, oh my God, I've really got to get this out of here for everybody's sake, not just me.
Carolyn Beeler visited a front yard in Elkins Park, Pennsylvania, to watch professionals go to battle with a serious patch of poison ivy, and she got a few new tips on avoiding the painful rash.
For the past few summers, homeowner Laura Frank has been managing the poison ivy in her yard just fine.
Cut it back, pull some out around the edges, and I thought that I'd be able to keep it under control that way.
This year, though, she was mistaken.
It absolutely exploded. It was just everywhere, and I realized looking at it that I was outmatched.
So, a few weeks ago, Frank called in reinforcements. A street crew worked nearby in the summer heat while horticulturalist Umar Micah surveyed Frank's yard.
You hardly see the poison ivy as heavy as this.
The dense thicket is about 30 feet long and 10 feet wide, covering the ground under a spruce tree between the driveway and sidewalk.
It's getting good sun, a little bit of shade, and it's got a nice open place to grow.
Micah's employee, Abdul Rahman Ilyas, is wearing arm protectors and gloves and has tucked his pants into long socks. He uses a shovel to loosen up the buried root system of the poison ivy before pulling it up, avoiding cutting.
It's a long root. You have to trace it all over to the end. If you cut it, it's going to grow up again. So you have to dig down, down, so that you get to the edge and pull it up.
Micah charges more than $1,000 for a job of this size. To avoid fees like that, he advises identifying and removing poison ivy plants when they're still young and small. The phrase, leaves of three, let it be, has been guiding gardeners since it first appeared in an elementary school reader around the turn of the last century. Micah says it's a little too broad, though. Box elder, raspberry, and Jack in the Pulpit have three leaves, too.
My clients say, gosh, everything has leaves of three. How do I tell beyond leaves of three?
Leaf arrangement is the key. So Micah invented an addendum to the old saying. Now he tells clients, leaves of three resemble me.
Leaves of three resemble me. Compare it to your body.
Picture a stick figure from the waist up. Two arms touching at the shoulders. Those are two leaves. And a head on top of a neck. That's the third.
Leaves of three resemble me.
More tips. Mature leaves are smooth-edged, while immature leaves have teeth. The plants themselves don't have thorns. Seeds spread through bird poop, so Micah says pay special attention to areas where birds congregate.
Look in those places for seedlings and remove them when they're small.
More than 80% of people are allergic to urushiol, the oil on poison ivy that causes the red, itchy rashes. Even if you've never gotten poison ivy, though, it's still wise to be cautious. Jason Lee is a dermatology professor at Thomas Jefferson University.
You will not get the rash typically first time you encounter the plants, but once you get sensitized, i.e., your immune system recognizes the oil, then subsequent contact with the plant, you'll develop a rash right away within 24 to 72 hours.
Urushiol absorbs quickly into skin. If you accidentally touch poison ivy, Lee says wash within 5 to 10 minutes with lukewarm or cold water and soap, and throw your clothes into the wash too. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Wandering bird dropped a seed, small and hard to see. Seed knew what it has to do. That's its destiny.
It's The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Emergency rooms and intensive care units are terrifying, almost violent places. Efforts to save a life can sometimes look and feel like the opposite. And many patients who return from the brink of death struggle with their experiences. A growing body of research looks into post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of intensive care. Laura Benchoff reports.
We're in a medical intensive care unit of Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, perched in a glass tower above a neighborhood of two-story row homes. This is where the sickest patients come when the emergency room can't do enough to keep them alive. Dale Needham is a critical care doctor at Hopkins.
Our patients may typically come in with severe infections, like pneumonia. Our patients may have organs that already don't work very well. They may have kidneys, liver, or lungs that don't work very well.
Doctors, nurses, and specialists here throw everything they've got at critical illness.
A Foley catheter, intubation. Through their vocal cords, into their trachea. Sedation, norepinephrine or dopamine. Large intravenouses, 20 centimeters long.
Despite all of these efforts, between 10 and 20% of patients admitted to most ICUs in the U.S. die. For some patients, the trauma of being close to death and the invasive treatments required to pull a patient back leave an emotional scar, post-traumatic stress disorder.
PTSD symptoms are quite common in ICU survivors. They may be as common as PTSD symptoms after active combat or after sexual assault.
Different hospitals use different scales, but between 24 and 42% of ICU survivors report symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. These symptoms include intrusive memories, trouble focusing, anxiety, and depression. And these effects last. Needham says that's a huge setback for patients in recovery.
So the impacts of PTSD certainly are very clear that patients had worse quality of life.
Garfield Griffin knows that firsthand. 3 years ago, Griffin was happily married, putting in long hours as the manager of a grocery store and raising his son Gavin. He was 39.
You know, I can hit the gym at 6, go to work by 7:30, get off at 6:30, hang out for a little while, throw the ball with my son, get up and do it all over again the next day.
Then Griffin got sick.
I thought I just had maybe a bad cold or maybe the flu. I've heard people have pneumonia, but I've never heard anybody go through what I've gone through.
Griffin spent 3.5 weeks in a Prince George's County intensive care unit, battling severe pneumonia. Doctors put a breathing tube down his throat and heavily sedated him, both practices associated with post-traumatic stress. While there, Griffin, like many ICU survivors, became delirious.
Nightmares, dreams, visions of just about any and everything you can possibly imagine. Visions of, you know, kids running around with animal heads. I don't mean to be too drastic, but I had thought that somebody cut my penis off. You know, I thought the people that were caring for me weren't. I thought they were trying to kill me. Blood circles, dark red blood circles, dripping blood.
Sick and scared, Griffin tried to fight back.
They actually had me locked down to the bed because I don't think that I would allow anybody to touch the breathing tube at some point in time.
Lucky for Griffin, he recovered from pneumonia, but he couldn't shake the bad memories. Back at home, Griffin had trouble putting his life back together. He took a year off work. His marriage faltered.
It's like you're in a funk. How am I going to get up to do anything when I can't see myself getting better? You know, I can't see myself breathing better. I can't see myself getting stronger.
During that year, Griffin decided to talk to a therapist. Through Dr. Needham, he joined a PTSD support group.
There were people that never made it back to work because of anxiety or fear of either getting sick again or getting yourself back in that position.
Back at Johns Hopkins, Dr. Needham and his colleagues want to prevent PTSD in the first place. Here's researcher Ann Parker.
The only intervention that was shown to substantially and significantly reduce PTSD symptoms in ICU survivors is the intensive care unit diary.
The diaries, kept by friends and family, describe what happens to a patient in the ICU. That way, when patients recover, they have a clear picture of their care, written by people they know and trust. ICU diaries are common practice in Northern Europe, but U.S. hospitals have been slower to adopt the technique. Here's Needham reading an example from the UK.
This diary is being written to help you understand what's happened to you in the intensive care unit. Your condition deteriorated and you were found to have stopped breathing and needed resuscitation.
Johns Hopkins will launch its own pilot ICU diary program in the fall. As for Garfield Griffin, he says he's moved on, but now doesn't take his life for granted.
It's not a day go by, I don't think about that. I mean, to be that close to death and it makes you appreciate life even more.
For The Pulse, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Coming up on The Pulse, contractions, snowstorm, stomach virus. Not a good combination.
JJ says, "The baby's coming now, the baby's coming now." My mom, who is behind her, sort of acting as a birthing stool, says, no, you don't need to push. She's like, no, the baby's coming now. Take off my pants.
The story of a very dramatic birth. Also, maximalist running shoes. Function, fashion, or folly. Still to come on The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Remember those barefoot running shoes everybody seemed crazy about a while back? They kind of looked like toe gloves and were supposed to keep runners' feet and bodies in the most natural position. Well, that's one class action lawsuit ago, and now there's a new best thing ever, a maximalist running shoe. Think platform sandal meets sneaker. Joining us now to explain is Brian Metzler. He's editor-in-chief of Competitor Magazine and Competitor.com. Hi, Brian.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for joining us. Brian, what is a maximalist shoe and what is it supposed to do?
A maximalist shoe is just a kind of a name that is given to a shoe that is an extra cushy shoe, a lot of foam underneath your foot. And the goal is just that, to provide a really soft, cushy, comfortable feel underfoot, but also cushioning from the point of view of support and resiliency as well.
And where do you see that trend coming from?
You know, it's interesting because this trend kind of came up about 4 or 5 years ago. There was two Frenchmen that had worked for another brand, had done a lot of mountain running, and really wanted a more cushioned shoe for the hard pounding of downhill running in the Alps. It's also been somewhat of a response now to people going away from the minimalist slash barefoot concept because they want more cushion. Most human beings, most runners, like softness underfoot. And I think that's why we're seeing that trend start to take off.
So is this the polar opposite of the barefoot style shoes?
You know, in some ways, it is completely the opposite of the barefoot minimalist style shoes. But in other ways, it's actually not. It's actually more similar than you'd think. Now, it's opposite in that there obviously is a lot of cushion and a lot of height off the ground between your foot and the ground. The way it's similar is it took some of the better aspects of minimalist shoes, for example, super lightweight fabrics and new construction techniques, and also just a more natural positioning of your foot. So you're getting kind of the best of both worlds if you want a nice soft cushion ride.
And what is the natural position of the foot? Because there seems to be some argument over that.
No, that's totally true. And certainly that's still debatable. But certainly it's about letting your foot hit the ground and roll through to the toe-off phase and push off without a hard heel strike. We're all different. We all have different physiques. Our gaits are all different and individual to us. But the notion of getting off the hard heel strike at impact and allowing for a smoother, less wobbly roll through the toe-off is one of the key parts of that.
Is there any science on these maximalist shoes, or is this kind of more research within the industry?
Right now, I don't think to date there's been an actual independent study. I know there's some people that are interested in studying them, and I know some of the biomechanists that are very interested and have tinkered around on their own. But as far as official studies, it's all been company-wide, meaning like the brands are doing it themselves.
Brian, you're a runner. Do you have a pair?
Yes, I've run in maximalist shoes for several years, but I will offer the caveat that I don't run in them every day. I believe that everyone should have a quiver of shoes, and certainly running shoes are expensive and it's hard to have more than one pair of shoes. But at the same time, I believe that there's a different shoe for different types of running, you know, whether you're running fast or slow or on trails or on pavement. And so, yes, I run in maximalist shoes and I like them a lot, yet I also run in more traditional styles, and occasionally I will run in a minimalist style as well.
For the not-so-serious runner, how important are the shoes? Is it fashion? Is it function?
That's a good question. And if you look at the sales numbers of running shoes, even in this day and age with all the technology and marketing and hype and such, one of the number one factors in shoe buying is still aesthetic. But running shoes are definitely important relative to every runner. As far as maximalist shoes go, I think people that have tried them and like them and really just engage with that soft, comfortable feeling. And afterward, there's less kind of a beat-up feeling to your feet and lower legs.
But what can our shoes do for us realistically? I sometimes feel like we expect too much from our shoes. Can they protect us from injury? Can they not do that?
That's a tricky question. I mean, certainly the most important thing, whether you're a weekend jogger or a once-a-week runner, is to be as physically strong as possible. And I don't mean by big muscles. I mean by having strong feet, strong ankles, strong lower legs, and a strong core. Most runners just want to run, and that's all they have time for, and that's very understandable in today's world. But the ability to do, you know, core work and, you know, leg work to be more strong will help you, more than anything else, be less injury prone.
Brian, do you see a new next big thing on the horizon in terms of running shoes?
People ask that all the time, and certainly, you know, new fabrics that are lighter but stronger, new fabrication techniques, you know, for example, less stitching, more welding, has allowed a lot of great things, including better flexibility. You know, shoes are generally lighter through all of this. The average running shoe has gotten lighter, which overall is good. If a shoe used to be 11 or 12 ounces, you know, now they're 8 or 10 ounces, and that's a good thing, I think, overall.
And the minimalist movement is not dead, right?
That's entirely correct. Actually, there's some great learnings that have been out there from the original minimalist shoes, and certainly the people and the runners that have adhered to that type of running and that type of shoe have done really well with it. I tend to think that those runners that do well in those shoes are very nimble, very agile, very strong, have strong feet, and they run in a certain style. But no, minimalism is not dead. It's actually very much alive.
And Brian, how many running shoes are in your closet right now?
You know, I haven't counted in a while, but if I had to guess, I'd probably say about 275 to 300.
Okay. Wow, that's a lot of shoes. Brian Metzler is the editor-in-chief of Competitor Magazine and Competitor.com. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Runners like cool sneakers. Check. Runners also seem to covet a slow resting heart rate, but that may not be a good thing. Joining us now is regular Pulse contributor Dr. Bethany Brookshire, also known as SciCurious. She's a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Bethany, why is a slow heartbeat a matter of boasting among high-performance athletes?
It's very interesting, actually. So I'm a half-marathon runner myself, and a lot of times when I'm at races or with other half-marathon runners, you'll hear people, usually the guys, boasting about how they got their resting heart rate down. So they'll say, yeah, you know, I started out with a resting heart rate of like 75 beats per minute, but you know, I mean, now I'm around to like 50. And, you know, they act like this great thing to boast of. A low resting heart rate in endurance athletes is kind of thought to be a sign of how fit you are. You know, if you're really fit, if you're in really good endurance shape, you're going to have this low resting heart rate. And so it's usually a matter of boasting because of that.
And what causes the slow heart rate?
So that was really interesting. Until recently, we didn't know. Most scientists thought that it was actually a difference in signal from the vagus nerve, one of the 12 cranial nerves, and that decreased signal from the vagus nerve caused a decreased heart rate. But as the author of this study told me, he said it was a case of the emperor's new clothes. There was just no evidence. So they started looking for what caused this low heart rate, which is called sinus bradycardia. And what they found was that it's a change in the expression of receptors in the pacemaker of the heart.
Hmm.
So your heart has an area, the sinoatrial node, it's called the pacemaker. And in this area, there's spontaneous firing of the cells in that area, the muscle cells, and they fire together. And that firing actually causes the rest of the heart to contract. So it's a pacemaker for a reason. The rhythm there determines the rhythm of your heart. And one of the channels, the ion channels, that's particularly important for that is called HCN4, which is also called the funny channel. And what they found was that in athletes, in this case, athletic rats and athletic mice, they had fewer funny channels. And this correlated with a low resting heart rate. So a athlete's heart is not as funny. It has fewer funny channels.
Why is it called a funny channel?
So it's a funny story. So it's called funny not because funny ha-ha, but because that's funny. The funny channel controls an ion current. It's a sodium-potassium current that goes inward to the cell. Okay, so the channel opens and sodium and potassium ions come in to the cell membrane. What makes it funny is most of the time those currents are activated when the cell is depolarized, okay? When all of the ions are rushing out of the cell and the cell is depolarized. The funny channel is activated when the cell is hyperpolarized, when things are rushing in. So it's a little odd, and so it's funny.
Oh, it's weird.
Yeah, it's just weird. It's funny weird.
So is the slow heart rate then a good thing, a bad thing, a neutral thing?
Well, for endurance racing, it's probably a good thing. But in the long run, actually, people who have these chronically decreased heart rates can suffer pacemaker problems later in life. When you're young and you're an athlete and your heart is all springy, your heart can go back to normal. You can recover from sinus bradycardia after your training is over. But as you get older, your heart loses its plasticity. And they think that you may recover less as you get older. And fewer funny channels means a slower resting heart rate. And as you get older, that means you may have pacemaker problems. So older athletes tend to need more pacemakers than non-athletes.
When you say pacemaker problems, you mean our natural pacemaker.
Our natural pacemakers, yeah. So they often need a supplement pacemaker.
Okay. And can we train our heart rate to be slow when resting, or is that just something people talk about when running marathons?
Oh, no, that's definitely a real thing. A lot of endurance athletes do have slow resting heart rates that they get from their endurance training.
All right, just by nature of running all the time.
Yes, or cycling. It's very common in cyclists.
As a half marathon runner, is your resting heart rate any different?
I'd like to hope that it is, but in fact, it's not. So maybe that's a good thing for my long-term heart health, but it does make me look kind of slacken.
Thank you, Bethany.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Bethany Brookshire of Science News. She writes for the educational blog Eureka Lab. It's time now for our series, Patient Files, your stories of illness, recovery, and healing. This week, J.J. Shirley and her husband, Raphael Cuniff, recalled the recent birth of their third child, Declan.
A few days before he was born, I and the two older boys had come down with one of those horrible 24-hour fever flu things. And then on a Sunday, on March 2nd, I realized that I had started early labor. And it was pretty mild and manageable. And, you know, I thought it would be like Shane. Shane, I was in labor for 34 hours start to finish. So I thought, okay, I got time. I got like a good day of hanging out at the house and doing whatever. My mom was here and my mother-in-law and also my best friend. And it had maybe started snowing already, or it was just a threat of snow?
It started snowing. It started snowing around 7 o'clock at night. And we were eating dinner, and I began to feel really ill. So ill that I didn't really finish my dinner, and I went up to bed. I had the shakes, and I was in and out of the bathroom quite a bit. I certainly couldn't have gone anywhere.
And I thought, well, I should probably call the birth center. We had all our boys at the birth center out in Bryn Mawr. But when I saw that he had the fever chills, I figured, well, I'm not going to call them now because he can't get out of bed. They're not going to let him in. So I got in bed. And sort of half slept through contractions, more or less, for maybe an hour or so. And then I got up and I got sick. And I thought, okay, now we have to go. We're done. We got to go now. Unfortunately, he had stopped shivering, although I don't think he felt very good.
I was like, this is just, it's snowing now. There's like a couple inches of snow on the ground. I'm incredibly ill. I'm like, JJ, just don't be in labor. Just stop that.
I was giving directions to my mom because I hadn't packed the last few things, like, you know, my toothbrush and stuff. And so in between contractions, I'm like, Mom, get toothbrush, bathroom. Okay, get this. You know, I basically sounded like a hippo. You know, that like horrible, like really guttural, like animal sound that you make when you're in late stage labor. We started to come down the stairs, you know, slowly in between contractions. And we got to the bottom of the stairs and my water broke.
My mom said, call 911. So I go to the kitchen because it's far too loud where we were, and I start calling 911, and I say, you know, we're having a baby here, I think. And they say, well, when are you going to have the baby? I'm like, probably right now. I'm like, okay. And then walked back into our hall where the stairs are and hear that the baby's being born. JJ says, the baby's coming now, the baby's coming now. And my mom, who is behind her, sort of acting as a birthing stool, says, no, 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 you don't need to push. She's like, no, the baby's coming now. Take off my pants. She's wearing her pajama pants. And so we're struggling to rip off her pajama pants. And as we take off her pajama pants, the baby's head is crowned, you know, fully crowned.
Raphael fortunately remembered from our refresher class that you have to check for the umbilical cord. If you're in a situation where the baby's being born without any medical attention, check to make sure the umbilical cord isn't, you know, wrapped around the neck, which fortunately, oh, no, it wasn't. It wasn't wrapped around your neck, so that was good. And then it was maybe, yeah, two more pushes, and he was out. He was born right into Raphael's feverish hands.
Yeah. We waited for the ambulance that arrived about a minute after Declan was born, and he was still attached with his umbilical cord. There were some kind of hairy moments there because he didn't breathe quite at first, or, you know, at least it seemed to us that he wasn't breathing as quickly as he should. He didn't cry. And the ambulance arrived as we're doing this, then we're screaming at them, come in here, move faster. Baby's not breathing right.
And he was fine. He had cried and started breathing. It was, I think, the normal, like, 15 seconds. It just seems a lot longer. But she wanted me, the paramedic wanted me to get up and go to the ambulance. And we said, well, the placenta hasn't come out yet. She looked kind of astonished and said, well, are you going to reach in there and get it? And I think I actually had presence of mind to say, no, it gets born any minute now. And then indeed, right then, it basically was born onto our hallway. And the paramedic kind of jumped back in surprise and shock at this thing that came pouring out at her with, you know, a whole bunch of blood. Very messy business, birthing.
JJ was wrapped in a white comforter, just having given birth to Declan, holding him wrapped in towels in her arms. The paramedics are walking out the door, and JJ's walking out the door. And opening those doors right there, those double doors, and the snow and the blood, the snow, the white comforter, and the blood. It was like a scene from The Shining.
J.J. Shirley and her husband, Raphael Cuniff of Philadelphia, and we have pictures of their son Declan's birth on our website, whyy.org/thepulse, and it looks just as dramatic as it sounded.
We spent a couple of days in the hospital, not necessarily expecting to, but we were so tired. And I was just laying on a cot in the hospital. It was like, I think you should admit me.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson produced this week's show with help from Brett Rader. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always enjoy hearing from you. Email us with your feedback, your questions, your ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.